You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you after an opening weekend when Jan Tratnik ruled himself out of contention for the Tour of Flanders by winning Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, thus exposing himself to the most obstinate curse in professional cycling, as discussed last week. And Wout van Aert did the opposite by proving faster than all except Rick Bossut, the bearded wonder of Belgian cycling, who enjoyed 15 minutes of fame after half-wheeling van Aert aboard his electric scooter following VA's victory in Kuurne, Brussels, Kuurne on Sunday. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll ruminate over a dominant start to the cobbled classics for Visma Lisa Bike, a frankly despotic beginning to Jonas Vingegaard's tour build-up in Spain, and perhaps we'll also assess the motivational tactics employed last week by Patrick Lefebvre with Julien Alaphilippe. Joining me to do all of that today is a man who rode Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, probably called Het Volk when he started, seven times, the last of them in 2021, becoming such a legend in Belgium that he has, or had, he'll tell us in a minute, his own fan club there with an Instagram account that proclaimed his the best moustache in cycling, hence better than Rick Bossut. So Rick Bossut was more of a goatee. It's Mitch Docker. First of all, Mitch, do you know who I'm talking about? Rick Bossut.
Went
around the world. The fellow, the rather sort of sturdy looking fella aboard the electric scooter. He's kind of a chaperone, I believe.
Yes. I have seen the clips. Legend. He was so cool on the scooter. I saw him running, and then I saw him on the scooter.
I read an interview with him actually, with Sportster, I think, and he talks about his pre-classics training regime.
He talked about
how he has to be in good, make sure that he's in good shape.
So
he's classics,
he's in good shape now, is he?
He's got good legs. He's got good legs at the moment. He's just come down from altitude. And Mitch, fan club, does it still exist?
They do, yeah. You know, I've met up with them each year I go across to Europe, and we've become closer since I've stopped racing. I've got a bit more time to drink beers and have fun. Great crew, really great crew, and they're still supporting me in my endeavours. I don't know why or how, but it's very fun. They just said, look, we just can't find someone else to support, and I've suggested other guys, but they said, look, they don't have the mo, they don't have the mullet, but they're a good crew. Shout out to them if they're listening. Great crew.
Also joining us today, like some mystical warlock or grim reaper of French cycling, for we often talk about curses that French riders need to break or will break when he's around, yet they couldn't shatter the one that has prevented a Frenchman from ever winning Omloop this weekend, François Tourmazeau. François, I wasn't aware of this until it was put to Christophe Laporte at the start on Saturday, that no French rider has ever won Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, but much in the same way that no Frenchman has ever won the Tour de France. Not in living memory anyway. Most of our living memories anyway.
Yeah, well, they're still the French are still the, you know, record number of winners for the Tour de France. But I agree, it was in another century, in another time, on another planet, maybe. And Omloop, I think that, yeah, obviously no French guys, but it's the same stuff. It's the sort of races that for a long time you didn't have many foreigners racing those races. It was nice actually to see the Spanish champion jersey at the front, you know, at the weekend in those classics, which means we've seen, of course, lots of Spanish riders, you know, Flecha or Oscar Freire, I mean, you know, do well in the classics. But it's, you know, more and more we get in there. I mean, the Spaniards start to like those races, and unfortunately the French riders not so much. But, well, we'll see. The season is just starting.
You know, I had a thought straight away. I was sure that Sylvain Chavanel must have been up there in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, a great classics rider.
Yeah, he was. But, I mean, like he actually doesn't have as far as I can remember, a big win. And he missed out shortly in a few monuments. But I mean, you know, he was a great classic rider. You had you had Frédéric Guédon was probably the best.
Roubaix winner, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, there's always been guys who liked the Belgian or the Dutch classics and or the Ardennes or in France, like Gilbert Duclos-Lassalle or Marc Madiot. But they were kind of, we've said this a million times, but the Tour de France is so much the focus of most French riders that whatever your qualities, you know, even if you're a born cobbles rider, you'll probably sacrifice your chances or part of your chances to be there on time for the Tour. You know, that's the thing that matters. Even for Duclos-Lassalle or Madiot, it was more important to be at the Tour than winning Roubaix in many ways. So, yeah, it may be we're... because Italians have a great record in the classics, maybe we the French are now the lame ducks of classics. I mean, the ones who are performing, I mean, of the big cycling nations, the ones who are doing not so great. You know, mind you, the Brits have not been doing too well either on the classics, I must say. So let's wait and see.
François, in preparation for this episode, I was just recapping or revising some of Patrick Lefebvre's sort of litany of backhanded motivational sort of barbs towards his own riders. And I found one that was directed at Chavanel a few years ago. And it was only by reading this, I remembered that Sylvain Chavanel was, for a very brief moment, I can't remember which year it was, maybe 2014, he was number one in the world, ranked number one in the world. And Lefebvre sort of suggested that his head had fallen off because he'd become number one in the world. He didn't really...
Chavanel is a very nice guy. He was a very nice guy, but he was too much of a nice guy. And that's my old my old motto or conviction that you need to be an asshole to be a great rider, and especially on the classics probably. And we'll probably discuss Alaphilippe, but I think that's one of the problems with the French riders. I mean, the great champions we had were assholes like Fignon, Hinault. And I'm sure they accept that. Even Marc Madiot. I mean, this guy, you know, but Chavanel was a kind of a softie, you know. He was not a killer. And I mean, maybe one of the reasons for that, which is not the case for Alaphilippe, but it's lots of these French riders, they spend, and we said that before as well, they used to spend so many years in the comforts of a French team with a good salary, racing Bessège, maybe Paris-Nice, you know, on home turf, and actually not many risks, not taking many risks, not challenging themselves. And that was a problem with Chavanel. He started to perform when he was with Quick-Step. The years he spent with Cofidis or Bernardot at the beginning, he didn't have to win. You know, he was paid well to just to be there. So I think that's probably the that used to be a problem. I think it's changing, as we see with the young Groupama FDJ riders coming up, or even Decathlon AG Tour, changing their philosophy. But it takes time to change.
Chaps, we must crack on with News Roundup, but first we'll have a Corrections Corner, a quick visit to Corrections Corner, first one of the season. In last week's episode, I was talking about Joaquim Agostinho, the Portuguese legend, and the tragic circumstances of his death. And I said I talked about this journey from Faro to Lisbon, and inexplicably, I said that it was about 10 hours. We were contacted by an illustrious former Giro d'Italia winning listener who put me right on that. It's about 3 hours from Faro to Lisbon. Also last week, our venerable colleague Rob Hatch talked about how upset Carlos Rodriguez would be about the Ruta del Sol being reduced to just a 5 kilometer time trial. Not only was Carlos Rodriguez not on the start list, but Ineos Grenadiers weren't even on the start list. Anyway, apologies for those. We'll kick off with talking about things that did happen. We'll kick off with one day races, and I'll go in order of importance with Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. First, took place on Saturday, as I've already told you. Jan Tratnik of Visma Lisa Bike, also the first Slovenian to ever win Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. He won the men's race, escaping with Niels Pollitt of UAE Team Emirates on flat-ish run into Ninova. and easily beating Pollitt in the sprint. This race was followed by the women's edition, the first women's Omloop in which another Visma Lisa bike rider, Marianne Vos, had ever taken part. And who should go on to win but Marianne Vos? The following day saw many of the same riders in action, men and women. The men in Kuurne, Brussels Kuurne, where Wout van Aert spent what seemed like the whole afternoon on a lovely group outing with Tim Wellens and Oyer Lascano, going on to comfortably beat that pair in the sprint. That was van Aert's first ever victory in Kuurne. No women's race there, but instead we had the Omloop van Het Hageland, which was won by Kristen Faulkner of EF Education first. One other elite women's race at the weekend, the Clásica de Almería, that was won by Lauren Stevens of Cinisca Cycling, who found himself in the news for other reasons yesterday. This related to the 2023 edition of the Argenta Classic, where Cinisca only had four riders, one short of the stipulated minimum of five, and they decided to circumvent that rule by disguising a team mechanic, Moira Barrett, as a rider with complete with face mask. This was considered fraud by the UCI Disciplinary Commission, and the orchestrator of it all, the DS Danny van Houter, has been banned until the 31st of December 2025. The mechanic has been suspended until September the 1st, 2024, and the four other Cinisca riders were reprimanded. Team will also have to sit out next race on the UCI calendar. Chaps, what a story. First of all, I'd quite like to see the mask that was used. Secondly, I suppose it's not really a laughing matter. I was sort of quite surprised at the severity of the sanctions, though. As I said, the DS banned until the 31st of December 2025. It brought to mind, I don't know if you chaps had heard this story recently. There was a Kenyan runner, an 800-meter runner, Michael Saruni, who was banned for trying to evade a dope test by employing a lookalike. This was the Kenyan Commonwealth Games trials, and he sort of disappeared into a toilet stall, and the lookalike was waiting in the stall next to this, and they sort of jumped over the wall, and Saruni tried to escape, but it didn't work. But what a story.
Well, it's like a work of fiction. I mean, if you have time to waste, go on YouTube and look for a movie, French movie called Contre la Montre. I'm telling you that because I wrote the script of it, and it was it was a fiction thing. It was not so bad. It was a movie that was released in 2001, and the whole story was a guy is about to be there's about to be a dope test in his hotel in the morning, and they're asking for this guy Daniel Freiber, and this guy Mitch Stocker goes to the dope test and says is Daniel Freiber, and the problem is that the commissaires, then the race goes on, and then the commissaires see that there's been, you know, a switch of a swap of riders. So one rider, you know, making believe is the other one to avoid a dope test. So, but that was fiction. And now some, you know, like in real life, I mean, this kind of story you describe and which happened, if you write a script, a movie script fiction about it, nobody will believe it. It can't happen, you know. Well, it did apparently. And as you say, I think it's in terms of sanction, it's kind of counterproductive because I mean they these guys were trying to organize a race, they didn't have enough starters, so there won't be another one. It's not like encouraging the race to go ahead in the future. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, we've often wondered, haven't we, about the Yates brothers. We've often had serious doubts about those.
I was going to say the exact thing. I thought, I won't say it. I thought, you know, for me, I feel like they look too different now. But when they first entered the peloton, I always joked about whether in a grand tour they could just swap out. Speaking of, interchanges in grand tours, they could have just done the sneaky interchange in a grandier, you know, just given the other one a week off and then come in to finish it off.
I don't know whether I've said this, I've told this story on the podcast before. I think I have at one of our live events. There was a period, the first couple of years when they were both riding at Orica, when it was, well, customary for one of them to be, if you were at a stage race, one of them was bound to be in the white jersey. And I think it was at the Vuelta 1 year, maybe 2016. Maybe they were both riding that year. And it was sort of Adam one day, Simon the next. And this led to great sort of confusion on my part. And one day I addressed the first question to one of them. I can't remember who it was. I addressed it to Saddam. I got in a bit of a pickle, and we weren't too many years removed from the end of sort of the Iraq war, and it was rather unfortunate. Chaps, we should probably move on. The next stop is the south of France. So Francois, you're not in the south of France, you're in Paris, you told us before we started recording. However, in the south of France, there were two exciting one-day races at the weekend, the Fun Ardèche Classic and the Fun Drôme Classic. Both won by UAE Team Emirates riders, the former by Juan Ayuso, the latter by Mark Hirschi. The UAE Tour had just started when we hit the airwaves last week. We were expecting a dominant performance by the home team, UAE Team Emirates, and particularly their leader, Adam Yates, the aforementioned Adam Yates. Well, we got none of those things, with Jay Vine and Brandon McNulty both faltering on the final day when one of the pair looked well-placed to take overall victory on Jebel Hafit. This after Yates had pulled out of the race with concussion following a nasty crash on stage three. The first six stages were won in chronological order by Tim Merlier, McNulty, that was the TT, Ben O'Connor, Merlier again, Olaf Coy, and Merlier again. Going into that last stage showdown, Vine led fellow Western Australian O'Connor by 11 seconds and teammate McNulty by 13. The American, though, blew up at the bottom of the final climb, Vine halfway up, which left O'Connor in prime position until Lotto Destiny's Lennart van Etveldt attacked in the final 2 kilometres and soloed both the stage win and the overall title by an agonising 2 second margin over O'Connor, who took second and 11 seconds from Peyo Bilbao. Just a quick word on this, chaps. At the time of writing, I think as we watched the stage, we all imagined there was something wrong with those two UAE riders and that they were sick, McNulty and Vine. Just listening to or reading their comments afterwards, it sounds as though it was more a case of the first part of the stage having been very hard. There were crosswinds and it was tough racing into the bottom of Jebel Hafit, and they seem to be sort of paying the price for that. Also, Ben O'Connor, Mitch, he was a bit of a sitting duck, to use the expression that Francois used earlier, I think. And I suppose he was kind of having to, well, his team, his Decathlon, Agir Deuxel and Mondial team were having to sort of not make it up as they went along, but they were in a situation they didn't expect to be in. I don't know whether he was able to keep track of exactly where everyone was on GC, because there were several riders in contention at that point. He couldn't follow every move, but he was sort of the de facto team leader. No one else was going to chase anyone, even though he had a slender advantage.
Look, I think it was really good, you know, the days before when, you know, they applied that team attack almost, you know, you call it, which you don't really see anymore, you know, where him and his teammate went off the front to launch him for that victory. It's quite good, and I like where Ben O'Connor's going this year and taking that sort of, I guess, pressure off his shoulders, announcing not going to the tour. I don't know whether that was a team decision, his decision officially. It seems that he is racing with a bit more freedom. He stayed in Europe all year this year, didn't come back to Australia. I was disappointed because I wanted to get him on the pod, and I couldn't get him. But, you know, couldn't get him live, that is. So, look, I think it's nice. And he's showing early season. I'm not really answering your question, but I'm just talking on a holistic sort of view of the way I'm seeing Ben Wright. It looks like, I remember catching up with him last year at the tour as he crossed the line, and he was a broken man. Can't remember what stage it was, but he lost that GC, and he was just, he looked like he was just lost. And it was a split second thing that I noticed in him, and I know it was after the race and the emotions, but I'm seeing a different guy this year, and I think we're going to see a new Ben O'Connor hit the season this year.
In terms of relieving the pressure that I think he's sort of laboured under for the last couple of years, Mitch, getting two early big results, the win in Murcia and UAE, that's going to be great for his season, isn't it? Because he's not a rider who, you know, his team are going to expect to win 10 races a year. So it's already it's already a good season, a good 2024 season. And
I think you raced perfectly on the last stage of the UAE Tour. He didn't jump. He knew at that stage, you know, at in the finale, that he was the potential, Tour winner. But he didn't jump after every move, you know. He paced himself. He came back and he did exactly what should be done. But just this young, Belgian guy, launched a brilliant attack, and it was very unexpected, and he was just the best man on the day. But I don't think, you know, Ben O'Connor has anything to be ashamed of. I mean, he really did the job the way he should do it. I think he's been in great shape since the start of the season. He controlled every move and everything. Only, you've always got this young up and coming guys, as we know, coming up, and this is another one, you know, who really boldly went for it and got the win, which is it's nice to see such exciting finales when all of the sudden the strategy, because as you say, we have Visma Leisure Bike, and we have UAE Emirates, we have the impression that those two teams are going to crush, you know, the season. And well, this showed that, you know, from time to time, the unexpected can happen. And that's when you've got fireworks, when anything can happen. And that's what that's what a great last 10Ks to watch, actually. Great.
And I think, sorry to interrupt, I think that's exactly a great point what you said there, is that these races are very hard to predict what they mean for the season. Not to take anything away from Ben O'Connor, but these surprise results are great races for young guys to try their legs out. They're all about data, because you can move around the peloton. You can easily get to the front. I'm not discounting how hard they are, because, you know, not that I was over there winning every race. But get them in the races coming up at Basque Country, Catalunya, and we see the cream rise to the top, because there's a bit more involved. So it is a hard one to read, but I agree with you, Francois. He rode really well in that circumstance.
Francois, it would have been the first French team victory in a World Tour stage race
since Carlos Betancourt.
Since the Colombian Rick Bossut won Paris Nice.
Yeah, and you could almost, you know, no disrespect to the AG2R team, but I don't mind sounding disrespectful to Carlos Betancourt, but you could almost rule out that win as well, you know, for various reasons. So yeah, it's been a long time. It's been a long time, really.
On that controversial note, we'll move on. And we talked last week about El Gran Camino, a sort of unofficial tour of the Spanish region of Galicia, where Jonas Vingegaard was beginning his 2024 campaign. Well, force majeure, race cancellations or alterations are becoming a bit of a theme. Spanish races this year, this one was no different. High winds prompting the race jury to rule in advance that the opening day TT had to be ridden on normal bikes and the results wouldn't count for GC. One suspects the winner would have been the same either way. And Josh Tarling did indeed take the stage. Thereafter, it was the Vingegaard show with the reigning being the operative word, dropping everyone on each of the three remaining stages. That gave him overall victory by 1 minute 55 seconds over Lenny Martinez. I looked this up, chaps. Greater than the winning margin in five of the last nine Tours de France after three stages. Third was the winner of one of those tours, the 2019 edition, Egan Bernal, a resurgent Egan Bernal. That was very good to see him looking in such good form and promises very well for the rest of the year. And we had a nice letter after last week's episode in which we talked about the eucalyptus trees and local festivals in Galicia, chaps, from a listener called Lewis James, who's a Cornishman who has settled in Galicia. We talked last week, as I said, about the eucalyptus controversy. Lewis James was very much of the view that the eucalyptus plantations are a blight on the Galician landscape, mainly because of the biodiversity argument. We didn't see many eucalyptus trees. We didn't see much of anything. It wasn't a particularly good advert for the beautiful region of Galicia because the weather was so wretched. It did make me wonder. I had this conversation with someone yesterday, chaps, why Vingegaard has elected last couple of years to start his season in El Gran Camino. It's a hilly race, which he likes, obviously, and he's won there on both occasions, but I'm not really sure why the choice has fallen on that particular race. It's kind of curious, but it's worked for him.
The funny thing is you could tell about the change of season because we have a new name for the team, Visma Lizopike, and we have a new name for Jonas Vingegaard as well, who is now Jonas Vingegaard Hansen. He took the name of he added the name of his wife to his new full name, which was, for a second, I asked myself, who is this man? You know, Jonas Hansen riding for Visma Lizopike. But, you know, it's different name, same rider, I'm afraid.
It's a pretty dominant performance there by him. And I wonder from a physiological point of view how that build goes towards the Tour de France and why there is such a necessity to dominate so heavily there. To go on that attack so far out, solo, and win by so much in the yellow jersey, going solo and just to completely obliviate the field. Like, I know it's I'm not saying he should, you know, make it even and all this sort of stuff, but I'm like, does the form need to be that good now? Or is he just still in a building phase? You know, is this just the level that he's at? But, or is that everyone just like so much less? It just looked like he was already in Tour de France form, you know, because it's so early. Does he completely shut it down now and rebuild? How does it go from here? Because clearly he obviously won the Tour with the same condition last year.
Remember last year he started this, well, he almost never lost a race. I mean, so it's kind of the way Vingegaard seems to be riding. And also it was interesting, as you mentioned, Daniel, to see, well, Lenny Martinez do, you know, the up-and-coming Frenchman in second place behind Vingegaard, and probably even more to see Egan Bernal back on a podium. So these are early season indications that, you know, of what to expect. Maybe it would be great to see Bernal, you know, back in to his best level. And at the same time, while Lenny Martinez and Romain Grégoire in the one of the two French races you mentioned, Daniel, who finished second behind Juan Ayuso. So it is up and coming, the Groupama FDJ team, showing, you know, that they might be ready for more. So yeah, it was an exciting week for predictions or, you know, forecasts or looking forward to the rest of the season for that reason.
I mean, it's just on that, the big hitters, the Galacticos starting their seasons in such barnstorming form. Modern GC riders just have no chill, do they? We're going to talk about, we'll talk about some more Visma Lizopike riders later in the episode who've come straight down from altitude and are competitive immediately. And that didn't used to be the case. I mean, anyone familiar with cycling, particularly stage race cycling in the early part of this century, I mean, if you'd told someone that, I don't know, a Jan Ulrich, for example, was going to come and start winning Spanish stage races in February or March. I mean, Jan Ulrich's main objective in sort of Spanish stage races in February and March was trying to sort of duck under the 100 kilogram bar. And that was pretty much his priority for the next 3 or 4 months. Anyway, chaps, last stage race we'll tell you about is Tour of Rwanda, which we've been keeping an eye on over the last couple of weeks. Just going to give you the winner of the race overall on GC. That was the 21-year-old British rider, Joseph Blackmore, representing Israel Premier Tech. Mitch, one reason we've covered this race over the last couple of weeks is that it was the last pro road race for someone you know well and featured on your pod, Skarbu Gamai, who was riding for the World Cycling Center for a sort of kind of farewell race. Sad to see Skarbu leave the pro road peloton, isn't it, Mitch?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that, actually, Daniel. I'm wondering how he actually rode back for, is it the UCI World Cycling Center, is that right?
Yes. So that was where he sort of started his journey way back, I think, in 2010. And he talked to them about the possibility of kind of coming full circle in his career. And he's going to be doing some work for them anyway, I believe, some sort of mentoring work. And he thought it'd be a nice way to sign off. He's also going to be riding some gravel races for the Amani team in the Girona area mainly. I think there are a lot of gravel races, sort of local gravel races around there, Mitch. And he's going to try his hand at that.
I don't know if this is 100% sure, but I think Skarbu took my house when I left Girona. So it's a bit of an odd fact for everyone. So he came around when we did the pod and we interviewed at my house. He said, this is a great house. He was looking around. He's very intrigued. And then when I left, I did hear this rumor that he moved in with his family. So I hope that is true and the house went to good hands because he is a seriously good guy.
Couple of other things, chaps. Peter Sagan is recovering from a heart operation after his heart rate soared to over 200 beats per minute in a recent race, and a minor abnormality was diagnosed. In follow-up tests, Sagan underwent a corrective ablation procedure and plans to be back in action at the Marseille France Cup race on the 17th or 18th of March, François.
Well, I might go.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the sort of prevailing feeling is in mountain biking, on the mountain bike scene, about how successful Sagan's going to be this year. But obviously, we wish him all the best with his recovery from that heart procedure. Doesn't seem to be too much alarm about it, which is good news. And finally, chaps, reports have come out of Italy in the past few hours suggesting that RCS own Giro di Sicilia, the Tour of Sicily, will not go ahead in April. It will be replaced by the Giro d'Abruzzo. That is a race with its own long, though quite stuttering, history, founded in 1961 and dormant since 2007. That will take place between the 9th and the 12th of April, we believe. Well, chaps, we have already told listeners, if they didn't already know, who won Het Nieuwsblad Omelet, Het Nieuwsblad at the weekend, who won Kuurne Brussels Kuurne, Jan Tratnik, the Slovenian rider of Visma Lisa Bike. He ended up beating Niels Pollitt in a sprint. And, well, for a long time, it looked pretty certain. Well, pretty much, in fact, after the provisional start lists were released, it looked pretty certain that a Jumbo-Visma, formerly Jumbo-Visma, Visma Lisa Bike rider would win Omloop Het Nieuwsblad because they fielded one of the, well, I think the strongest teams ever fielded in that event. So they were very much the favourites, also based on what they achieved last year. The way the race panned out, chaps, now it was an aggressive start, all sorts of splits in the first couple of hours when we couldn't see the race. It wasn't on TV at that point. When the cameras were finally sort of switched on or we could see them, there was a large and significant, I think it was a 23-man break. As we got towards the pointy end of the race, Mitch, and you can talk about this in a moment, about exactly where the pointy end of Omloop starts. There's a 23-man group and a lot of good riders in there. I think Visma Lisa Bike had four, Ineos had four as well. And as they got to the Wolvenberg, 52 kilometers to go, Matteo Jorgensen led onto there. And, well, a group was able to detach itself, and a very good group it was too. Jorgensen, Delee, Pidcock, Schuyens, Gianni Moscon, briefly, Van Aert, and Laporte. And they stayed together. Those seven riders, or with the exception of Moscon, who got dropped, as I said, shortly after the split occurred. And then Visma Lisa Bike, well, before we started recording, Mitch, I suggested that it maybe looked as though, and this is sort of the narrative, and what's going to be the narrative of this classic season taking over, and this idea that maybe Visma Lisa Bike are in danger of becoming complacent. It almost looked as though they had started to think about who was going to win and not necessarily whether they were going to win. They fired Jorgensen down the road before the Mur van Herausbergen. He led on to the Mur van Herausbergen. And then to everyone's surprise, really, because we'd sort of written off the peloton. At one point, they were well over a minute back from that seven-man group. The peloton sort of appeared over their shoulder. Tim Wellens really appeared over their shoulder, and in his slipstream came the whole peloton. Didn't quite all come back together over the Mur van Herausbergen, and indeed Jorgensen was still away on his own at the bottom of the Bosberg. But then it really did regroup, and it looked as though Visma Lisa Bike had squandered the advantage that they had had, and that wasn't what's in fact materialized, because they were still able to, I suppose some people will say, rescue victory from the jaws of defeat, in that Jan Tratnik was able to get away with Niels Pollitt. On paper, Tratnik not known as a fast rider, a fast finisher, and Pollitt on occasions has won small bunch sprints, small group sprints. We feared for Visma Leasebike at that point, but Tratnik had simply more power in the closing meters and was able to take an easy, well, comfortable-ish win in that sprint. So Mitch, let's start to pick this apart, what you were able to sort of see and decipher of a classic edition of a classic race. There were so many sort of different phases of the race. As I said, there were moments when we were absolutely sure that the race was done and dusted, that those seven riders were going to contest the win, and it looked as though it was all set up for a kind of routine Wout van Aert victory or a Christophe Laporte victory, as much as a victory in a race like this can ever be routine. But shortly thereafter, it was all looking very, very uncertain again.
Well, in the old worlds of my old words of my old teammate Matt Heyman, as with the classics, is just keep riding. And an interview after the race from Jan Tratnik was exactly that. And maybe that's what it worked out. He was dropped in the crosswinds. He got distance because he's in a bad position, so he said. And maybe that relieved him a lot of duties. He was then playing the policing role behind, because that group got away with three, Visma, Leasebike, you know, Jumbo riders in the front. So he was then playing the policing role behind, you know, how do we keep these guys away? Had a bit of a softer ride than if he was in the front of the bunch, having to play a different role. He then came back, as we saw, and maybe just had that little bit of spark left in his legs to launch that attack, which he wouldn't have had if the race had gone another way, pulling, setting it up like Jorgensen. And I would almost say, like, Matteo Jorgensen now being in a team where he's actually having to do a job in the classics and not being a leader has allowed him to be a better rider in the classics, if that makes sense. If he was in, and I use this Cortina, Ivan Garcia Cortina example in Movistar, if he moves to a team where he has to be our worker, has to be in the position to work for other riders that are better, he's going to ride a better classics race opposed to trying to ride for himself, if that makes sense. There's this pressure.
Chavanel, who Francois talked about earlier, was a great example of that.
Exactly. You know, like these guys, they get in a position, they're doing the job, they're not thinking about, oh, I should save energy here. They're just committing to the job. Next thing they know, they're in a group of six over the top of, you know, the Wolfenberg. To speak about the race itself, when I raced it, there's two things that I remember from Omloret Nieuwsblad in the later editions was the Molenberg was a key point. There was a race into the Molenberg, get on that left turn, you cut up the inside. My job was to get the leaders into the Molenberg. That was my job, day done. Molenberg was the end of the race now. You know, it was done and dusted. So that just seemed like a nothing climb now. And what the similarities I'm seeing with Jumbo is the quick step of the old. Who can attack first gets to win. If you remember this with quick step, I heard this rumor was they were just like, if they were four or five in the front group, or three or four, whatever, whoever gets to attack means the other guys can't chase him, so he gets to win. Terpstra would go early. You'd see Stijn Vandenberg go. Boonen would probably wait as well. Then you also had Gilbert. He would go. They'd go on these long-range attacks because they thought, if I don't attack now and my teammate attacks, I have to sit here and protect him. So maybe we're going to see this with Jumbo, as we saw with Jorgensen going, and these guys are like, well, if I don't attack now, I'm going to have to watch my teammate ride away and get the victory. That's the sort of similarities I'm seeing with Jumbo and Quickstep of the old when I used to race was, you know, I was watching it on TV, not that I was there witnessing those attacks, but I would see that, and I think it was funny. They're just sitting there going, damn it, I can't chase my own teammate. We're going to watch my teammate ride away and win. Yes, we're happy, but I had the legs to win today. So that's a weird sort of conundrum these guys are going to get into. When you were sort of saying, are they complacent? Are they sort of waiting around, you know, we can choose who wins? I think maybe that's the scenario they're going in, is going, well, I want to win today, but so-and-so's up the road, you know? Well, how am I going to win? I can't chase him down. It's a bit of a weird conundrum.
Yeah, I must admit, that's one of the things in this sort of burgeoning empire that they're building. That's one of the things that's impressed me the most. I know we had the situation at the Vuelta last year, which eventually, well, it led to Roglic leaving the team. But they've managed to keep things pretty harmonious thus far, particularly when you consider, well, but harmonious at least as far as we on the outside looking in are concerned. There haven't been too many sort of wrinkles that have appeared. Too much sort of tension that has bubbled over there, not that we're aware of anyway.
Probably. Well, because if you see the results of the weekend, you've got Tratnik wins one day, Jorgensen was up front, then the next day Wout van Aert wins, and Laporte is always in the mix. Well, he didn't ride Laporte, but so everybody's happy in a way. And maybe the tactics you described, Mitch, about the old days, regardless of the result, it's always best to attack because, and as we saw with Jorgensen, if your guy doesn't go all the way, you don't have to chase him, which means that if he's caught by the other guys, then you can counterattack and you haven't done any work and you're fresher at the finish. So it's always, that's what happened, you know. Tratnik, as you said, managed to come back when there was kind of a lull at the back. And then he didn't have to do any chasing job or teammate job. And so it was much easier for him. Whereas Niels Politz was one of the guys who did most of the work to get back on Jorgensen, and then he was finished, you know, in the end. So this tact, when you've got a strong feel like Visma Lizobay have, well, obviously, because they showed it at the weekend, it's best to send a guy up front. You know, either he goes all the way, or you've got a second chance, or a third chance, or even a fourth chance. You know, and that's what makes them strong.
I think also it's also really smart when we're talking about these guys being happy about the races they have. And you mentioned that Laporte wasn't at Kerna. I've seen that he's on the start list, and I think one of the favorites for Strade Bianchi. You know, maybe they just give them the different goals. And it'd be a smart way of going, look, that's yours, you know, that's your race today, that's your race next week, and you've got the team role today. So they're completely happy to play that role. Of course, Jan Tratnik, when you get dealt that hand, you roll with it, but you're not sitting there going, oh, geez, well, when's my turn going to come? Because, you know, Van Aert's winning every other race. They've sort of separated them around a bit, as much as they can, I guess. And then when it comes to the monuments, you got to go with the best cards. So maybe that's the tactic, and it'd be a smart tactic to play it that way, to spread it out and have different leaders at different races.
There are two points I wanted to make. You mentioned Tim Wellens earlier in the episode. Is one of the riders I really love. I think he's a great rider as such, very versatile and also a great guy. I mean, every journalist who's interviewed Tim Wellens in one of the at least three languages he speaks, because he speaks perfect French, great English, and of course Dutch, And I'm always sorry for Tim Wellens, because as we saw in Kuren, he was probably the strongest guy that day, well, with Van Aert, of course, but he doesn't sprint too well. He's not a sensational climber, and he's that type of rider who's so good, but you know, it would take very special circumstances for him to win something huge, you know. And I'm always sorry for him because he's so good, such an all-rounder with class, and yet it's difficult for him to win the monuments. And I wanted just to pay homage to Tim Wellens, because as you might know, he might not be that famous, you know, outside of Belgium, because he usually has problems in July with allergies. And remember, in the Tour de France, he refused to take corticoids to cure himself. So that's another thing I wanted to say about Tim Wellens. Great guy, refuses to take even AUTs, TEUs. And that was one point I wanted to make. The second question I wanted to ask you guys, because I ask it myself, that when we were at these early races, that the question of preparation comes into mind. You mentioned altitude, but we saw Tom Pidcock, who is back from doing the mountain bike and cyclocross cyclocross, how the fact that you've been at altitude doing cyclocross or mountain bike, how does it affect the approach to the big ones? Well,
also, before Mitch answers, also bearing in mind that Van Aert, no sooner had he won Kuurne than he told us he was going to, well, he's missing Strade Bianche and he's going to do another block of altitude now before what he considers to be the sort of real Cobble Classic start.
I would love to know what they're doing up there because they are nailing it. And we've seen it in the past with teams like, you know, the old Sky. They used to go up there. It was working for the Grand Tours. Let's take the Classics team up there. And I remember it just didn't work. I remember speaking to those guys. They're like, we're just missing something. We're just pedaling too slow. We've been riding on mountains the whole time. And like you said, in my mind, the perfect preparation for the opening weekend is mountain biking, is cyclocross. That fast twitch fiber, that fitness you need coming in with a bit of racing under the belt. Clearly not. Jumbo-Visma have worked out the way to master both. You get the fitness from altitude, that overall fitness, but in my opinion and my old feelings from altitude, you lack the punch, you lack the snappiness, that pedal stroke you only get from racing. So whether they're up there, I don't know this, and maybe I need to do a little bit of research and speak to some guys about what they do up there, is it whether it's motor pacing, whether it's the type of training they're doing, or whether they're just fluctuating between the heights and training low, sleeping high. I don't know what it is. I'm sure they've worked it out and they're nailing it. It's clear because they're dropping down straight into the hardest racing, the most demanding of races. You know, it's a stage race. You can get away with a bit of altitude, but these races, you have got to be race fit.
That has been a bit of a theme over the last couple of years I've mentioned, Mitch. It used to be common and pretty frequent to hear riders in interviews or team managers, coaches, talking about how they'd got the altitude block wrong or how they'd misjudged something and how, you know, they'd come down and not been on the form that they expected. I'm hearing that a lot less now. My impression is that the knowledge on that has become a lot more refined and people know exactly what to do. Also, you know, riders living at the wrong altitude, for example. I mean, there's been this trend over the last few years, you know, people go and live in Andorra, some of them for, you know, there are tax advantages as well, but some of them have bought houses. We heard last year from James Knox on the podcast, he'd bought a house, I think at 2,000 meters altitude, and sort of reflected that it's probably a little bit too high. We also heard Tobias Foss a couple of years ago, he was spending all of his time in Andorra and was struggling with the altitude at 1600 meters or whatever. But it seems to me as though, well, I'm sure this is the case, that the understanding is really improving about exactly how altitude's affecting performance.
I probably are going to go against what you said with not in the exact same way, but what I was trying to say is I think everyone's going to altitude a hell of a lot more. And old pros will just say the exact same thing as me. When I started back in the day, you know, it was like one altitude camp a year. If you had enough money, you'd go up there and do it. And so that effect, there was this whole acclimatization to it, and this whole period afterwards, you had to get used to coming back down again and all this sort of crap. Towards the end of my season, I just pop up and down, you know, I do little 5-day blocks, 2 days off. So I was just always sort of used to it. There was no coming down and acclimatization. These guys have gone to the next level. I speak to these guys, they're at altitude, I don't know how many times a year, a ridiculous amount of times a year. So I don't think the effect of coming up and down is an effect at all. So I think they're getting the continuous, whether they're down, they're intense, and whether when they're up, they're training high, they're doing their efforts up high. Their power isn't dropping down. So when they're training up high, we used to drop our power because, you know, the effect of the oxygen and on your power. Now I'm assuming they're training at the same wattage when they're up high. So that effect, I can only imagine that to go sort of against what you're saying, guys, living up there all the time and having that effect. I think they're just up there so often, all these pros now, that it's just something that they're used to all the time, tents, altitude and everything.
We will actually just pause to hear from a rider who we know, because he told us last week, did not train altitude before Omloop, but he was doing warm weather training. He was on Gran Canaria. I'm talking about the British road race champion Fred Wright and Bahrain victorious rider who went into opening weekend with pretty high hopes. And well, Fred unfortunately didn't finish Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. He was 21st in Kuurne, Brussels Kuurne. And well, he did just send us a little dispatch after opening weekend to tell us exactly how his weekend had gone. So here's Fred Wright.
Well, I went in to opening weekend with a lot of positivity, but we've sort of came away pretty disappointed, I think. Saturday on loop just missed that first split, unfortunately, but you know, stayed calm, knew that, you know, the race still was potentially going to come back together, which it did in the end. But I had to have a bike change at a pretty bad time, and then also got caught behind a crash. I changed the bike, was going to get back, and it was looking okay. Obviously, that takes a bit of energy out of the legs, and then came back to the bunch, but the road was blocked because there'd been a crash. So then was chasing again, and that was basically race over for me. Just finished in the last group. But Sunday was a lot better though. I was happy with how I was feeling on Sunday. Just when Wout opened the gas on the cobble climb, the legs really exploded when the race winning move went with still like 80k to go. And then me and Mate found ourselves in a decent select group, but we wanted to end up fighting for a bit of a result, but the bunch caught us, and then Mateusz, who I was trying to lead out, crashed on the last corner. So yeah, it was an opening weekend to, I wouldn't say forget, you know, you got to reflect on, you know, what went wrong, what we also did well. Like Sunday, I thought we raced really well, just didn't get any reward for it, but that's the sport. Saturday, I was pretty disappointed, but Sunday was sort of confirmation that I'm in the right place. So in the right place, but with nothing to show for it. But that's bike racing sometimes.
Mitch, just thinking about the teammates and the strength in numbers that Visma Lisa Bike have, and we're all sort of waxing lyrical about at the moment. At the Tour de France last year, something struck me, something very sort of practical and unromantic, something that wasn't really getting mentioned about having lots of teammates and having a strength in numbers. Cooling and hydration, but particularly sort of cooling in the very, very hot weather. This has become a bit of a theme over the last couple of years, and riders talk about it more and more. And just the number of times when sort of Adam Yates was pouring water over Tadej Pogacar, and both riders mentioned this, and other riders in that team talked about how important, what an important role that had been. It just made me think, are there sort of practical, again, unromantic, seemingly what we might think would be trivial reasons why it's important in the classics to have a lot of teammates in a group that aren't to do with, you know, being able to fire lots of guys down the road or being able to sort of, you know, lead a train, just simply practical things?
Well, look, it's quite hard to get bottles in a classic and get food. You know, even this is a ridiculous thing, but you can get so cold in a classics race that you can't get stuff out of your pockets. And it comes to a point where you just keep pushing on. I can't get it out. I can't get it out. And it can sometimes take a teammate to go, hey, can you get the gel out of my pocket? It's just the angle of someone being able to reach out of your pocket, hand you a gel, or even just they've got a feed bag, they can grab you, give you a gel. The obvious tactical side is great to have numbers there to, you know, launch guys up the road or, you know, in my case, chase back on to, you know, Gruppetto if I can, or even find your way back to the bus, you know, if you've got, someone's got a Garmin when you dropped. But, you know, carrying gear, you know, gone are the days, the glory days where you used to be able to just sort of hand off a jacket to the crowd and feel like a rock star. You've got to try and hang on to your rain jackets and stuff now. You weren't getting as much kit towards the end of my career. But yeah, it's very handy to have those guys, especially if you've got guys who know the roads. That's probably the biggest element. And I used to lean on guys, and I mean this with definitely no disrespect, they weren't necessarily massive champions. But they lived in Belgium. They were Belgians who would give me the tips. Oh, wait, just wait here. Don't have a piss now. because we're going to go up here. The road's going to open up. It's definitely going to be crosswind here. And you're like, how could it be crosswind here? The wind's coming from front. And then you're like, no, no, no. And then you'll be like, oh, right, perfect. I'll have a piece here. Or let's move up on this next bit. Those little bits about general knowledge, about knowing, like if I was to race around the town where I'm living now, the amount of stuff I would know if you guys rocked up here and raced tomorrow, I'd be like, no, 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 don't move up now. Let's wait till the road rises.
Still, Mitch, because I've heard riders suggest that the emphasis has gone off this slightly because they do spend hours at home, or they're supposed to spend hours at home researching routes. I mean, Jan Tratnik, for example, he gave an interview with a Spanish website, Relevo, last week to one of our colleagues, Fran Reyes, and I think it was to Fran, and he talked about briefings, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, how briefings now, a standard briefing before a stage, before a race, is 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and they go over every manhole cover pretty much. So is it not a bit less important than it was once to have that sort of field-specific knowledge?
For sure, less important, but we're talking about the minute sort of differences. And I heard Fred last week. I was quite impressed with his knowledge of the climbs and the names of the climbs. Less impressed with, say, Matteo Jorgensen in an interview after the race, not knowing the climb he was even attacking on. So a guy like Fred's got the interest, and you'll get specific people who have the interest. I had the interest. I went up and lived up there. I wanted to know the climbs. You know, blah, blah, blah. Yet some guys just, they're really good and they just like, cool, I don't know what that was, is one of those things. So those guys can learn a lot more. Look, I think like anyone who says they race in their own country, there's a home ground advantage. There definitely is a home ground advantage. You're never going to get that from those meetings. You'll get a hell of a lot more than we used to, but you're still never going to get that. You're never going to know coming into the Eichenberg, you see the red door from 100 meters away. As soon as I see the red door, I've got to move up. That's the thing that everyone knows. Who cares about that? If you don't see the red door, it's not time to move up. Going to the Eichenberg looks the same every corner you're coming around. As soon as you see the red door, it's time. You've got that one move to go. So, look, I'm talking about guys who are at my sort of level who need those every advantages. If you're a superstar, you can sort of move around. But that could be the difference between winning and losing.
Just on Jan Tratnik, worth mentioning as well that this is a rider, well, whose story is pretty inspirational, or would be inspirational for, I suppose, any kind of journeyman professional who never sees themselves, can't envisage themselves ever winning a classic like Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. Tratnik started his pro career in a way that a lot of riders would love to start their pro career. In 2011, he rode for Quickstep and had a single year with them, didn't go particularly well. And then he sort of bounced around minor teams, spent 5 years mainly in Austrian Continental Division teams, then went to the CCC Polish Pro Conti team before arriving at Bahrain Merida in 2019. And since then, well, he's only really gone in one direction, and that is upwards. He's 34 years old. In that same interview I mentioned with Relevo, he talked about riding until he's about 40, he thinks, he hopes. An incredibly versatile rider. He sort of confounds all usual sort of attempts to categorize riders. He's not really a climber, not really a time trialist. He can do a bit of everything. It was interesting talking after Omloop Het Nieuwsblad about those sort of 5 or 6 years in the wilderness, so to speak, riding for minor teams, and exactly why he hadn't made his breakthrough sooner. And he sort of opened up about the problems he'd had with weight and eating disorders, and they had really blighted him for a long time. And obviously he's now conquered that and is thriving at Visma Lisa Bike. Chaps, just a word on Koerner as well on Sunday. The decisive move there, well, it went with about 90 kilometers to go. Lascano, Wellens and Van Aert. Van Aert, it's another semi-classic added to his collection. He talked after that about, well, how he was encouraged by his form. Obviously, he's had to change coaches. His previous coach has gone with Primoz Roglic to Bora Hansgrohe. He's changed a few things, changed his race program, not doing Strade Bianche, which he's pretty upset about, but wanted to try something different. Just thinking about the classic season ahead, Mitch, last week we talked about why no one has ever won Omloop and Tour of Flanders. in the same year. And this sort of period, this kind of Bermuda Triangle between these 6 week period between the two. And is that the main reason? Is 6 weeks just it's just too long to sustain the same kind of form? We'll have other riders at Paris-Nice this week. And, you know, I've heard riders at Paris-Nice in the last few years talk about how that race has ruined their form. They've gone too deep. There have been other years when I've heard that, you know, Tirreno hasn't been hard enough, and that's ruined people's form. So just talk to us a bit about this period now, which starts.
It's so funny, the Tirreno, the Paris-Nice, for a classics rider, I can only talk from the classics rider preparation and view, is that they're two different races, they're two different beasts, and I hated Paris-Nice, but I always knew it was the best race for me to do the classics because it felt like the classics were a step down, if that makes sense. Paris-Nice is so stressful and so hard that suddenly you went back. Opening weekend is like a real rude awakening. You're like, oh, I'm back in the classics. This sucks. Everyone is fighting for every inch. This is just hell. You go to Paris-Nice, it goes up another notch. You're like, what is this? Why am I even a cyclist? I hate this. And you go back to E3 or even get Wavelgem. And look, they're still very stressful races, but it feels like, oh, I can sort of handle this. And I sort of like that. Whether it was the form, whether it was the stress, I think Paris-Nice was a better preparation for the Belgian classics. Tirreno is a race that is a slower start, yet it's got weirdly a harder final, if that makes sense. You know, Paris-Nice seems like it's just an overall amateur sort of hard race the whole day from start to finish. You're just side by side racing. Tirreno's got that feeling where you roll off the line. Yeah, has the brake gone, has it? Oh, I didn't even realize. Great. And then at the end, it's like, oh, I'm dropped. So it didn't work well for me, Tirreno, because I would be that guy who just got dropped. So I just sort of like, I didn't really do much today. Whereas Paris-Nice suited me. It was just sort of on the edge the whole day, like a classic. You got to be burning the whole day. They're the two differences, and riders like them for different reasons. You know, some guys like to just have that slower, and I use that word very loosely, a slower start and a massive final. That's great to prepare for, you know, the classics end of the race. And I think the thing that I used to know about the big riders was they come to a race like Paris-Nice or Tirreno with a little bit waiting to find that last little percentage in these races, use these races to find that last 10%. If I and the riders of my level, the domestiques of the world, if I didn't go to Paris-Nice at 100%, I wasn't really finishing Paris-Nice. And I made that mistake one year thinking, yeah, I'll go there for my last 10%. I just hung on for grim death the whole week. And I realized, okay, for me to go the extra level, I need to go to Paris-Nice at my top level and come out. So your question is, these guys who are flying now, and it's a different peloton, it's very hard for me to comment about what's going on now because things have changed since the COVID. We've discussed this a million times. You know, the form that I see these guys in, I just don't know how they carry that form over a massive stage race coming up next week with Strada with a higher importance again. You know, the sixth monument, as it's called. And then into the classics, you know, Roubaix's a long way away. And let alone the physical form, what about the psychological energy that these guys are spending? Every one of these races literally rinses you out psychologically. By the time you get to Roubaix, I can tell you a lot of guys are thinking, it's the worst feeling you can ever have on the start line of Roubaix. I can't wait to fly home tonight at the best race of the year. You want to be at the start line of Roubaix going, oh, I cannot wait to race. And then, you know, to go back again to my old friend Matt Heyman, I think mentally that was one of his keys when he won that year. He missed that classics. He came in so mentally fresh.
I have another perspective that's interesting. That's the organizer's perspective, because I know very well François Le Marchand, who is the guy who designs the course for Paris-Nice, and they're aware of the fact that some guys come to Paris-Nice to win Paris-Nice, or the GC riders have different approach to the race, that's, you know, different from sprinters or classic specialists. And there was a time when the organizers would think, especially ASO, well, the only classics we have is Roubaix, and it's a long time away, so we're going to have a very hard Paris-Nice because we don't care about the what happens at the classics afterwards. But they realized that if they were you know, if they were having a too hot Pyrenees, then they might not have as many sprinters as they wanted. And also, they have to take into account the fact that from some riders, it's a preparation for Milan-San Remo or, you know, or other classics. Because if they want to attract these guys as well, they have to take this into account. So from it's funny that from an organizer's point of view, who wants to have the best race possible, he also has to take into account the fact that, you know, riders have a different approach to the race, and as they want the big names and in the race, so they have to take into account the fact that, you know, some guys are coming to prepare for the classics. Right, we'll have a couple of stages just meant for that, you know, and it's interesting to see how the whole calendar, you know, comes into the mix when the I'm sure RCS, you know, for Tirreno have the same approach. Like you can't not take into account the fact that there are, you know, up and coming races, and that you have to adapt what you do with your race to the rest of the calendar. And that's also interesting.
The Cycling Podcast. For the latest news, views, and interviews from the world of professional cycling.
Lionel, how the devil are you? Fancy seeing you around these parts.
Hello, Daniel. Yes, a bit out of practice. Am I doing this right?
I think you are. Lionel, it has been opening weekend in the old cycling, the road cycling season. And it's, well, the start of our season as well, certainly as far as the friends of the Cycling Podcast are concerned, is it not?
Yeah, it is. All of our listeners will probably be aware that the Friends of the Podcast program, since it started in 2015, way back in 2015, it's always been a really important part of our fundraising to enable the Cycling Podcast to do the work that we do. And that financial support directly enables us to send people off to cover the grand tours. And it's especially important at times like this when we don't have a title sponsor. The Friends of the Podcast episodes have been somewhat dormant since last July. Daniel, as you know, our Friends of the Podcast episodes were largely based around the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France last year. And we've decided that we're going to go back to our roots somewhat this year and have a little bit of a reboot and a rebrand of the Friends of the Podcast episodes.
Not just a little bit of a rebrand, Lionel, a fantastic, wonderful, hopefully seismic rebrand that's going to rock the cycling media landscape. Friends of the Podcast, well, Friend Specials, Lionel, are going to cease to exist in their current form, or what they were under their previous guise. Is that correct?
I guess so, yeah. In name only, really. We've established all these things over the years, haven't we? Friends of the Podcast episodes, Friends Specials, Kilometre Zero. And, well, we're just streamlining, simplifying the branding, aren't we? So Friends of the Podcast subscribers will get access to all of our Kilometre Zero episodes. And Kilometre Zero, which has traditionally been based on our Tour de France, Giro d'Italia and Vuelta a España coverage in the past, will encompass all of those kind of special episodes.
It's growing, isn't it? It's expanding significantly.
It is, yeah. So a Kilometre Zero could be similar to those Grand Tour style episodes, or it could be a documentary style episode, or some of the travelogue extravaganzas we've done in the past, or it could be a long form interview or an in-depth investigation. We're commissioning a couple of those at the moment, aren't we? But basically, Friends of the Podcast will be able to listen to Kilometre Zero, and Kilometre Zero will be, roughly speaking, a monthly thing. We're returning back to how we started the Friends of the Podcast episodes. Back in the beginning, it was conceived as an idea to release something once a month. And so from March, from next month, there will be something to listen to or watch, potentially. Is that right, Daniel?
We'll get onto that in just a moment. That first Friends of the Podcast, Kilometre Zero. I'm confusing myself now. Lionel, don't call it a comeback, but it will be featuring, starring Lionel Burney, will it not?
Yeah, well, it was recorded last year at Milan San Remo. So Spring in San Remo will be out in a couple of weeks' time in the build-up to the first monument of the season. A little mini-series being produced by our fantastic producer, one of our fantastic producers, Tom Wally. So the first kilometre zero of 2024 will be Spring in San Remo. And then we will continue releasing episodes on a monthly basis after that.
Yes, so just to recap, starting, well, before San Remo, Kilometre Zero will be called Kilometre Zero, not Friends of the Podcast Special. Then monthly, will there be something every month? And then, as always, Lionel, at the Giro d'Italia, we'll be doing Kilometre Zeros. We might rejig the timing of those. Previously, we have released three a week. We might tweak that slightly, but you're still going to get those episodes, similar content, as we've always done. Same at the Tour de France. And one thing we're adding this year, we're going to do Kilometre Zeros at the Vuelta a España as well, which we've not done regularly in the past. Plus, Lionel, we're going to be offering something else in the Friends of the Podcast Kilometre Zero program. That's going to be Kilometre Zero Live, a series of, we think, six live events, which any friend of the podcast is going to be able to attend.
First one
before the Giro d'Italia.
Indeed. And if anyone wants to sign up as a friend of the podcast, if you're not one already, go to thecyclingpodcast.com, and it is £25 for a year's access to the Friends of the Podcast program. And that support goes a very, very long way to ensuring that we can, well, send you and Brian off to the Giro d'Italia in May, first of all, Daniel.
Indeed.
On with the show.
Well, chaps, the cycling world, or the focus of the cycling world, moved to Belgium last week. There was lots of racing going on, as we've already discussed, but Omloop Het Nieuwsblad took centre stage. And, well, Belgium and its roads will take centre stage for a lot of this spring. And with that, well, comes a lot of focus as well on certain teams, certain personalities. Patrick Lefebvre is someone who very much occupies center stage around about this time of year. That's pretty a pretty regular occurrence in the spring and during the classics period. And opening weekend was foregrounded by a story that garnered a lot of attention. And that was comments by Patrick Lefebvre in an interview with the Belgian magazine Humo about Julien Alaphilippe. Alaphilippe, who, of course, has been, well, he had been the talismanic figure of the Quickstep team, Soudal Quickstep, for many years. His status in that team has sort of waned a bit over the last couple of years because Remco Evenepoel is the flavour of the month. The comments from Lefebvre, chaps, I'm sure the listeners probably all read them. Two sort of key statements that he made, or key criticisms of Julien Alaphilippe. He talked about the mega contract that Alaphilippe had signed. That was in April 2021. So between Alaphilippe's two world championships, two rainbow jerseys, Lefebvre said to Humo, too many parties and too much alcohol. And then, equally sort of controversially, he went on to mention Alaphilippe's wife. Francois,
they're married.
Yeah. He said he seriously... Now, the translation that I've seen of this, and I've seen it translated in various languages, he's seriously under Marion's spell, or he's seriously kind of under her charm. I suppose there are different interpretations of that. One might say that he was talking about the sort of depth of their Julien's affection for his wife. Others interpreted that as Lefebvre saying that Marion Rus was meddling in Alaphilippe's career. However, this sort of led to other stories. There was another one in L'Equipe, which was interesting, Francois, from your colleague Philippe Legault, talking about, well, this reputation maybe that Alaphilippe has gained over the last couple of years of being a bit of a party boy, or he had gained up until a year or so ago. There was talk in Philippe Lagarde's piece in L'Equipe about him sort of keeping teammates up at night with his phone ringing late in the room, sort of boozy evenings on training camps. And well, this raised several questions, chaps. One of them, obviously, is Lefebvre's motivation for making these comments. There are several sort of plausible explanations. None of them are fully convincing. You know, is he trying to sort of cajole, inspire, poke Julian Alaphilippe, motivate him? Is he trying to trash an asset who is coming to the end of his contract with that team? Can he simply not help himself? Does he get a kick? And this is something that I've always thought about Lefebvre. When you interview him, there's a kind of, when he delivers his sort of killer payoff line or punchline, you see the twinkle in his eye, and he simply gets kind of gratuitous pleasure out of knowing that he's delivered something quotable to a journalist. That's what I've always seen. Rather than, I think there isn't a calculated aspect to it. But there's that question. What exactly was Lefebvre up to? Does he have any right to make these comments? Secondly, talk about someone's private life, even mention someone's wife. And just motivation in general, Mitch, as well. How should a team manager, a direct sportif, go about getting the best out of a rider who's maybe not performing at the level they once were? I don't know who wants to go first. Francois, you know Julian Alaphilippe well. One thing that caught my eye as well today in L'Equipe was another team manager that you know well, Jean-René Bernardeau, the Total Energy manager, talking about how he would gladly take Alaphilippe on. But just in terms of background, Alaphilippe and the last couple of years and how his results have dipped. Obviously, he's had crashes. He's had a lot of misfortune. What's your take on this, Francois?
Well, the first thing, his reputation as a party boy is probably right. But, I mean, some guys, I mean, all the riders are different. And some guys need that, you know, to get rid of the pressure by being, you know, I'm not saying by indulging into alcoholism or anything, but by partying, by taking the pressure off. Other guys deal with it differently. If Julian Alaphilippe is a party boy, he was a party boy when he was world champion twice. I mean, it didn't seem to affect his results in the past. So the simple things that apparently Lefebvre refuses to admit is that, you mentioned crashes at the season when he crashed at Liège. It was not his only crash. He crashed a number of times. Since then, he's been crashing much more than in the past. Like, confidence has gone, you know, when you have a big crash like this. He used to be very handy with the bike, very skillful, and he seems to have lost that. Also, he's 31 now. I mean, and in the type of rider he is, there are many, there's at least a dozen younger guys who are the same type of riders as he was, and are simply younger. So it was obvious, even when he signed a contract in 2021, it was obvious that, you know, he was taking a risk by giving so much money to a rider who obviously would wane and falter because he was simply getting older. So I think it's a little bit unfair. My impression, I have two ways of seeing it, and I agree with what you said before about the twinkle in the eye. I can see Patrick Lefebvre saying these words, like tongue-in-cheek, you know, like, you shouldn't take me seriously. I'm kidding, you know. But when it's on print, you don't see the twinkle in the eye or the joke.
Yeah,
you know, the joke.
I don't think Lefebvre is fully, and we talked about this last week. We talked about a post that Theo Gegenhardt had done on Instagram where he talked about kind of riders not being able to, not knowing how to sort of communicate their personality. And I talked about how social media has changed things and how riders are basically terrorized now because they've all had the experience of saying something which was either a criticism or just something they had on their mind. And then it's feeding the sort of social media machine for the next two days, 3 days, 4 days. And I don't really, I think Lefebvre has found himself in this situation many times over the last few years where he said something and it has fed the social media monster, he would probably say. So it's not like it's his first rodeo. However, he seems to be struggling to get his head around this. Mm. The fact that you do say something now and people do strip it out of their context. And there is some context to this. He went on to clarify that he was referring to the end of 2022, and in the interview it was as though he was talking about 2023. And so there are some nuances that need to be kind of layered on top of this.
But dimensions of Marion, the more awkward, as if you know Marion Rousse, in spite of her, you know, she's quite popular, she's quite famous, she's you know, the boss of the Tour Féminin, she's a consultant for several networks, radios and stuff. And if my impression is that if Julien is under the influence of Marion, it's a positive influence. She's doing a lot of good to the guy, is, you know. And if what Lefebvre wants to say is that Marion Rousse and their life together and their kid are more important to our priority for Julien more than his racing career, well, I think that's fine. You know, I think that's the way it should be. So, and not the other way around. So in the end, what I think is that it's just a way for Patrick Lefebvre to admit and to put a final mark on their partnership together, because obviously the contract, Alaphilippe's contract is ending at the end of the season, and the question now is what is the future of Julien Alaphilippe in the peloton, because he also hinted, I think it was in Cycling News, that he might retire at the end of the season. So to me, what Lefebvre said, however, whatever he meant, is a clear sign that whatever happens, Julien would probably not be with Quickstep at the end of the season. So what is his future? Has he had enough? I was talking about assholes at the start of this episode. I don't think Julien has ever been that. I don't think Julien has ever been a killer or an asshole. I don't think the cycling career has been such a priority. I don't think cycling is 100% of his life. And that's the point.
He didn't do himself any favors at the weekend when he had several crashes in Omnipet Newsblad. And one of the crashes, one of the bike changes, it was right outside a chip shop, a friteur. And he disappeared inside and came out with a battered sausage and a cone of chips. And I thought that's not true. But he was right outside a chip shop, which I thought was unfortunate. Also, slightly unfortunate timing as far as the Sudal Quickstep team were concerned, that they did a podcast with him and that was released the morning of the Lefebvre's comments. Part of a sort of effort, I think, to get the team sort of image back on track after the merger rumours and all of that this winter. But Mitch, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I think that there's a couple of things out of that. I think one thing that you, to come off the back of Francois, is that people have got to realize that, you know, this mysterious state of, you know, and I think most listeners probably know this, but if they don't, I'm going to point it out to them, that once a team decides that they're useless, they've decided to get rid of the rider, or they don't like the rider, whatever, that's done. That can be done a year, 2 years out from the end of their contract. And it seems like that's what's going on here. You know, people might be thinking, yeah, but he's still got, you know, a whole year ahead. It's weird how quickly teams will just write you off and just either sideline you or just, you know, badmouth you or whatever it is. And they'll already be just thinking about the next year. Cool, Alaphilippe's done with us. And you're thinking, you're still paying him for like a whole season. But they're like, nah, that's we don't care about that. So that's something to think about, that could be a possibility. And look, just purely on the motivational side of things, if that's what he's going at, that is a common trait, you know, not to this extent, with team managers, team sports directors, to apply this negative motivation, I'd call it that, where it's like, let's put them down and they're going to rebel, you know, sort of, I'll prove you right, you know, and, you know, come back. Because I get the feeling that a lot of sports directors and, you know, team managers even have been pros themselves, and that's the way that they got motivated, by being told, you can't do that, you're no good anymore, and they want to prove them wrong. So they're like, well, that sort of worked for me, so I'll apply the same pressure. It doesn't work for everyone. There is an element that, you know, I think everyone in any walk of life, sport, whatever, wants to prove someone wrong when they get that. But if you keep applying it too hard, some guys kick back. Amazingly, a guy like Michael Matthews, he was amazing at that. He could come back and just go, I will prove you wrong. It was amazing. I used to watch it happen personally myself. I loved being sort of fluffed up and told that, you know, give me a bit of belief, you know, and give me a bit of confidence. You know, Mitch, I reckon you can get over that climb and, you know, lead Magnus Cort out in the Vuelta. I was like, holy shit, they think I can do it. And I'd try and do it and I would do it. And if I received, you know, nah, you're never going to make it, mate. Of course, I was sitting up, rolling in, taking it easy. So they're two different, you know, tactics. And I'm talking, this is on another level. This is out in the public. So what that does to him, I get the feeling that there's going to be an element of, I want to prove you wrong. I want to show you something else, but it might be out of his hands. You know, sometimes it's out of your hands. Look at a race like Omelette Nieuwsblad. He was out of his hands. He crashed. Was that because it was just, you know, the situation, or was it because it was fate? He was trying too hard. He was trying to prove so hard that he had to, you know, show the world that he wasn't that he was in the wrong spot at the wrong time, forcing it too much. It's a bad dynamic to be in. You don't want that from the boss, let alone anyone in your team. You want that confidence boost.
Chance, I thought we'd just conclude. I should really stress, this is not to suggest in any way that Julien Alaphilippe has been overindulging in alcohol, but the mere mention of alcohol and the sort of suggestion that it might affect someone's performances, I just thought it would be worth asking you to about how cultures have changed on that score. Obviously, alcohol and cycling are, well, they have been bedfellows to a certain extent since day one. I've got some notes here. In the first Tour de France, Maurice Garin prevailed partly because his rival for overall victory, Léon Georget, abandoned the race from Bordeaux to Nantes, citing digestive issues caused by too many biscuits, strawberries, and a red wine called Brutal. And there are many, many, many stories going through the annals of professional cycling, of wine, beer being involved. Chaps, as you both know, these days, the last few years, it's a well-documented phenomenon that people are drinking a bit less. Young people are drinking less. Gen Z has also been sort of nicknamed Generation Sensible, drinking less than any generation that's gone before them. Mitch, did you see attitudes change over the years? You know, maybe once upon a time, a couple of beers, team dinners after races, that was seen as normal, and then it became frowned upon. Did you see anything change?
I don't think, yeah, look, especially in Orica, Greenwich, you know, we started, you know, all guns blazing and a massive opening sort of training camp here in Australia. And, you know, things tightened up after that. But, you know, we generally saw a bottle of wine on the table most dinners, which wasn't like, you know, get pissed and airs, party, whatever. It was just culture. You know, like being in Europe, being in France, there's a bottle of wine. Yeah, cool. Most of the restaurants just put it there complimentary. So we had it, but that got removed. And even a rule got put in place at Green Edge that no drinking on races. You know, we had to have a rule in place. And pretty much from those days early, I want to say 2014, 2015, on those days, there was a shift where I never really saw it go back to just sort of control yourself and make your own choice. It was like the team had to make the choice for you. We won a race, you can have a champagne. If not, no drinking allowed on the racing. So, you know, probably in the first 5-6 years of my career, it was up to you and, up to your own discretion.
Francois, you must have some good stories about alcohol and cycling.
Oof. Tell us. If I get it right, the first world champion in the history of cycling was a Frenchman on, you know, on these big bikes with the big wheels. I think he was a noble guy called Deligny or something, and he was the world championship were held in the Parc de Saint-Cloud. He was dead drunk in the finale. They thought at the time that alcohol was a doping product. I remember stories of François Faber winning a stage maybe in the west somewhere, and he finished the last 10 case with a bottle of brandy, and was that drunk? And so they used to be part of the culture, way of life, in the same way as, and in the north of France, in the same way as you had cobbles on every street up to the 1950s, it was common even for kids to drink beer because water was not drinkable. So I mean, there was a culture as well of this. These days, well, of course, the cycling journalists never drink. I've known a pro rider in his last season. Was preparing very hard for Paris-Roubaix. I spent a little bit of time with him on the Tour de France, and he had a couple of beers and a couple of glasses of wines. I seem to remember, the guy with the mustache. So, anyways, I must say I've seen guys get pretty strong on alcohol in the peloton now, but he was in the Canadian Grand Prix in Quebec and Montreal. For a lot of riders, it was the last race of the season because they were not going to the Worlds, and they were all staying in the same hotel. There was a nice bar in the Frontenac in Quebec, and you could see and there was a bar as well in the hotel in Montreal, and there was lots and lots of riders at the bar at 2 a.m. I can tell you. But the thing is, end of the season, kind of relief at the end of a long season. And yeah, I mean, they're young guys, they're healthy, and there's nothing wrong with them, going for a few beers and a few too many from time to time at that stage of the season. But I agree with you that that's probably been a very strong change of culture from the past.
It's not too long ago that we heard stories. Heinrich Hauser tells a great story of winning a Stage of the World to hungover, or maybe even still slightly drunk. You used to hear stories from the Vuelta a España of that nature. Not anymore. And Julien Alaphilippe, according to Patrick Lefebvre, teetotal, or nearly teetotal, since November 2022. Anyway, so the one thing I would say is I would keep your eye on both the Belgian media and the French media over the next few weeks, because both the Alaphilippe camp and the Lefebvre camp, they have a lot of friends in the media, and if one, it could become a bit of a tit for tat in terms of leaked stories. The problem is, I suspect that both parties have got ammunition on each other, so they might not want to sort of draw each other into that kind of war of words.
Well, the last thing I can say, we found ourselves back, a few times, we Lionel, yourself, and Richard at the time, in the same posh restaurants on races as Patrick Lefebvre. And if you wanted to know what the best wine on the wine list was, you looked at Patrick's table and it was there on the table.
We're talking about, I did a wine column with Patrick Lefebvre for a year in Pro Cycling Magazine. I used to phone him up every month just to ask him about wine. So for him to be accusing someone of overindulging in alcohol, take some neck. Well, that's just about it, chaps, for this week. I did want to look ahead a little bit to Paris-Nice and Strade Bianche at the weekend. We've run out of time to do that. Paris-Nice, it's going to be a battle. I think most people expect it to be a battle, a head-to-head battle between Remco Evenepoel and Primoz Roglic. So there's going to be lots to talk about from that race. I'll be there. Francois, you may make an appearance on the podcast next week talking about what's going on there. We've got Strade Bianche, of course, at the weekend with Tadej Pogacar making his season's debut. Again, we will be reviewing that next week. But chaps, in the meantime, I'm going to thank you and wish you a very pleasant and sober. Well, it doesn't have to be sober. We're allowed to. You're allowed to, lubricate your evenings on the Cycling Podcast. Anyway, Mitch Docker, thank you very much.
Great to be on here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Francois.
Thank you very much.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.